This from Sam to open up today's show. Oh, God, here we go. Kevin, time for a name conversation again? Question mark, question mark. Trump was asked about it, and he's in favor of going back to the old name. What say you? I say, Sam, for me, anyway, it's probably time to stop digging. Good morning, everybody. Tom's thoughts, as in Tom Lavero's thoughts, on the Rizzo and Davey Martinez firings coming up in about 15 minutes. Grant Paulson will be on the show with us at 11. We'll talk some Nats and maybe do some football as well. Before I get to what Trump said about the name yesterday, I think it was, he also said something about the stadium. I wanted to just mention what I've been watching here. Max, for the last hour and a half. In fact, I have it on right now in my studio. Since about 8:30, I've been watching the Wimbledon quarterfinal match between number one in the world, Sabalenka, and Laura Siegemund from Germany. I talked about Laura Siegemund 2 years ago after her first round loss in the U.S. Open to Coco Gauff. And I came in here and did about 15 minutes on that match because she was booed out of the stadium by the Arthur Ashe Stadium New York crowd because of the way she plays. It was a very tight match. She lost that match in the first round to Coco Gauff in three sets. And I said I thought it was thrilling sports to watch. It was thrilling tennis to watch. Because this woman, Laura Siegemund, is 37 years old now. She's the oldest player since Billie Jean King back in the 70s to make the quarterfinals of Wimbledon. And she does it with not overpowering strokes, ground strokes, or an unbelievable serve. This is the ultimate in craftiness, the ultimate in brains over brawn. I mean, I have, from very much a distance since that night against Coco Gauff, and I was rooting for Coco Gauff to go into that evening, and then I found myself rooting for this, at the time, 35-year-old German who was being booed for her slices and her drop shots and her taking time in between serves. She's very deliberate. She's slow, admittedly slow. But whatever she can use within the rules to get an edge on her opponent, I love watching those players, those teams that are undermanned or overwhelmed athletically that still compete and can still win. She's got 12 wins in her career over top 10 players. She's into the quarterfinals of Wimbledon for the first time. She reached the quarterfinals of another major back in 2020. That was the last time, at the French Open in 2020. She's been primarily a great doubles player. The night that she lost to Coco Gauff and was booed and jeered, as the ball was tossed for a serve, people were yelling and sneezing. It was really a very awkward night. This was in September of 2023. And she got multiple time violations and even was, you know, penalized a point for sort of delaying and playing slowly. You know, they now time in between points, but it's loosely sort of regulated if you watch tennis. And she came into the press conference that night, and that press conference has been watched millions of times, and she broke down. She was very upset. She said, I I'll net it out for you. She essentially said, I gave everything I had on the court. The match was a high level match, and no one respected it or appreciated it. And she said, she admitted, I understand people rooting for the American. You know, I'm German. When I play in Stuttgart or anywhere in Germany, they're rooting for me, but not at the expense of the opponent, not sneezing with the ball up in the air on a serve, not yelling out during, you know, a second serve. Not cheering double faults. Now, that happens in sports, and I think tennis players get a little bit too sensitive when it comes to things like that. But I remember that night watching her match and then watching the press conference and becoming a fan. And I'm not sitting there watching Laura Siegemund matches, but in the majors, I will always kind of keep an eye to see if she's won a match or two. And she does pretty well, but she does better in doubles, and she's get injured a lot. She's 37. That is grandmotherly in that sport of tennis. That is so old, especially on the women's side in particular. And she has gone through the draw here at Wimbledon. She beat Madison Keys, who was the sixth seed in the second round. It was a big upset. She's won two times since, and here she is in the quarterfinals. And she won the first set against Sabalenka. They're in the second set right now. And she won the first set with just this incredible array of tennis shots that you just don't see very often. I was listening to the pregame of this with guys like Brad Gilbert. Brad Gilbert had the, you know, back in his day, his game was made of junk. I mean, junk shots, because he wasn't, you know, the most talented. And to watch Sabalenka, who is an overpowering, clear-cut, massive favorite in this match, minus 2,000 to win this match, and she still might win this match, and is the number one in the world and the heavy favorite to win Wimbledon. To watch her struggle with these sliced returns, these drop shots, and then mixing in power occasionally with 78 mile per hour first serves. I love that. I love the player or the team that is not undermanned, but clearly overmatched by the opponent, and they figure out a way to compete. They figure out a way to make it interesting, to give them the best chance to win, because that's the ultimate goal. Entertaining the crowd is not the ultimate goal. Winning for her is the ultimate goal. I actually wagered this morning on her. All right, +6.5 games for this match. +6.5 games at -110. It was basically even money. And I bet on her to win the match at +750 to win the match. Now, I wasn't expecting her to win the match, but I'm like, she'll junk it up enough. She'll use her craftiness, her brains, and she's very competitive. She's 5'6". She's nowhere near the size of some of the big tennis players on the women's side. It has been compelling as you know what to watch. Love sports when it's that kind of matchup and that kind of David versus Goliath. But Goliath, you know, David is using guile. You know, we've seen pitchers do that. We've seen, you know, basketball players. She plays at her own pace. She's never rushed. It's fun to watch. Most people hate it. It's interesting. You know, the players can't stand it. They hate to play her. And yet here she is, 37 years old, in the quarterfinals of Wimbledon, and she is up a set and on serve in the second, down 3-2. I will keep you posted on this match. 37 years old, beating number one in the world. This would be a huge sports story around the world, not necessarily here. We don't love tennis like the rest of the world does. South America and Europe and Australia love tennis. I mean, it is way up there on the list. But this would be a massive sports upset if it happens at Wimbledon. I'll keep you posted on all of that. So, back to Sam's note to me. Kevin, time for a name conversation. Again, Trump was asked about it, and he's in favor of going back to the old name. What say you? Play what Trump said, Max. Was this yesterday or the day before?
This was yesterday during the show. Yeah. That's when it came out. Do you want the commander's name or the RFK bit?
The name.
Okay. Yep. Let's hear Donald Trump on the commander's name.
The Commanders changed the name back to Redskins.
Well, you want me to make a controversial statement? I would. I wouldn't have changed the name. But that's there. It just doesn't have the same. It doesn't have the same ring to me. But you know, winning can make everything sound good. So if they win, all of a sudden the Commander sounds good. But I wouldn't have changed the name.
Okay. I mean, honestly, I've read the what he said, and now hearing that with a little bit of tone, I mean, it's what everybody has kind of said. You know, most people, certainly who have followed this story, a lot of people, certainly fans of the team, longtime fans of the team, you know, understand that there wouldn't be anything wrong with going back to it, but it ain't going to happen. And I said at the top of the show just a few minutes ago, I said, for me, it's almost like it's time to stop digging. Not that I've been digging recently. I've come to grips with it ain't ever coming back. Sabah, I mean, bless her heart. Every DM she sends me, or certainly 80% of the DMs that she sends me, are name related. You know, what have I been saying all this time? Commanders, Magic Johnson, this is your golden opportunity to do the right thing and give us the Washington Redskins that we all know and love, HTTR, for our name, hashtag. Kevin, please push this. Stop saying the name is never coming back. Be a failure, not a quitter. I love that. Kevin, keep talking about her name and stop saying it will never come back. Keep the pressure on Josh Harris. Remember, Snyder said in all caps, I will never change our name. And he changed it. So just because Josh says we are not changing our name doesn't mean it's over, but we must keep fighting. Yeah, I'm tired of the fight, honestly. Most of you know how I feel. For those of you who don't, I think it was ridiculous that this wasn't debated in a much greater way. It was always a debate. It was always a complex conversation. It was never the mic drop moment that the anti, you know, Redskins people thought it was. Dictionary defined race, you know, racist term, or, you know, pejorative or insensitive. You know, it never meant that. It hasn't meant that for 75 years. You know, the word Redskins, as we've talked about many times in the past, has meant for the last 75 years, and language does evolve. It does. That's why you see dictionaries petitioned for updated definitions of words, because language evolves. And that word has meant the football team, professional football team that plays in Washington. Or the word Redskin means a football player who plays for the pro football team in Washington. Like, I've always used that example. Nobody walks into a bar and says, hey, man, there are a couple of Redskins over at the bar. And the other guy says, oh, really? Some Native Americans? No. They'll say, is Jaden Daniels one of them? You know, is who else is there? Is Bobby Wagner over there? Because that's what the word means and has meant for years. But here's the problem. Twofold. One, it was lost because Dan didn't do a good enough job of, first of all, getting closer to significant and meaningful Indian reservations. He didn't do a good enough job preventing it with, perhaps, as I've suggested for 15 years, petitioning dictionaries for a second non-pejorative definition. But lastly, and this is the most important part, Dan not being a decent human being ultimately cost us the name. Not just because, you know, of the Fred Smith situation, you know, in the summer of 2020. And look, everything was ripe for being canceled in the summer of 2020, even things that were silly to be canceled. And we understand that more today than we did in that moment. But the all caps was just stupid. He was antagonizing the other side when it came to this. And there was enough data to speak for itself. He should have been pushing with Indian reservations. He should have been pushing dictionaries. He should have been behind the scenes, you know, creating an environment of a decent human being owning a team with a name that is controversial, yes, but a very complex conversation, and certainly not leading to any compelling reason to get rid of it. But because he wasn't a good person, because he wasn't very bright when it came to this, it got in the summer of 2020. And if it wasn't Fred Smith, it may have been somebody else. So it's over. It's been over. The NFL is a $25 to $26 billion industry. They're not going back or allowing Washington to go back to something that's unnecessarily controversial, no matter what arguments make sense to end the controversy. Those that are spending the money, networks, big NFL corporate sponsors that create this $25 to $26 billion industry don't want it. And they don't want the league to go back to it. It's much easier for them to stop it now, since it's gone, than it was to get rid of it when it was here. But it isn't here anymore. The horse left the barn, people. It's done. They have said this, you know, over and over again, whether it's Mitch Rales or whether it was Josh Harris recently. Now, the changing the current name to me is a completely different conversation. Obviously, I would want Redskins back. Of course, I would want Redskins back. And I felt that way my entire life when the name was still there in terms of pushing back on those that wanted it gone. And once it was gone, I wanted it back. But I know where it is now. It's in the hands of the league and the league's $26 billion, you know, revenue partners. It's not coming back. And then there's the whole idea of, can they go it alone without that name or without changing the name and create the kind of business that they want to create? And I think they feel after last year, and last year made it a lot easier, 12-5, two playoff wins, created this path of least resistance, because early in the season, it was still being debated among the people out in Ashburn about what they would do about it. They got kind of a gift horse, you know, and they didn't, you know, they didn't stare it down. They took it. And is it possible that somewhere down the road we could get, you know, another idea for a new branding? Yeah, but only if they turned into a loser. And with this quarterback, I don't think they're going to turn into a loser. So I think it's over. I think it's been over. I hate it. Like all of you do, or like many of you do. But I kind of know when it's time to stop digging. It may not make sense to a lot of normal thinking people about this name. But again, the unnecessary controversy that even the discussion of bringing the name back would get is not going to happen with the powers in the NFL running a $26 billion industry. Dan had a chance. He had a chance to approach it in a different way, a more strategic way. But he was, as we know, not very strategic. He was impulsive. And that's the way he operated. And so it'll never, ever, ever, never, ever, ever change, in all caps, was the impulsive emotional response, not the response of somebody thinking this through. There could have been a lot of work with, you know, dozens of influential and big Indian reservations. It's the same thing that, you know, the Seminoles do, Florida State and others do. There could have been. I recommended it to Bruce Allen in our studio 15 years ago. Why don't you petition dictionaries for a second non-pejorative definition? He was glossed over, had no concept of what I was suggesting. And I said, it happens all the time. And this one really makes sense. Maybe it wouldn't have been accepted, but, you know, it was worth the try. And then just being decent human beings during that whole process probably would have helped them. But they weren't any of those things, and they didn't do any of those things. And because of that, they were an even bigger target when it came to the name, because they were dumb and arrogant and not good people for the most part. So, I'm never going to stop feeling about the old name the way I felt my entire life. I'm just not going to continue to say, and I haven't said for a year now, at least a year, that it's possible and that we need to keep up the fight for the old name. No, it's not coming back. I still have hope that one day the current name would go away to Washington Football Team, then we could just call them the Skins. I call them the Skins anyway a lot of the time. But the old name's not coming back. I mean, I pray I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure I'm not. All right, Tommy was on the podcast with me yesterday, and I think you'll want to hear what he thought. Nobody knows in this market Davey Martinez and Mike Rizzo better than Tommy does. Tommy has spent a lot of time with the learners over the years, usually antagonizing them. But he was on the podcast with me. You'll hear what he says next. Once I mentioned Laura Sigmund, she hasn't won a game since. She's about to lose the second set down 5-2, but that'll take it to a third set still. She makes things interesting, for sure. All right, Tommy was on with me yesterday. Tommy knows Mike Rizzo well, Davey Martinez well. He has certainly spent a lot of time following this ownership group. So let's get to what Tommy thought about the firings of Mike Rizzo and Davey Martinez.
Well, you know, look, I beat this drum. And there's people out, some people out there that don't want to hear it. You know, they look at Mike's record of drafting, you know, after they got good, and it hasn't been that good in player personnel drafting, okay? And they look at the way the team plays sometimes, particularly of late on the field, where they look like they're not disciplined, their head's not in the game, and that reflects poorly on Dave Martinez. I get all that, okay? And that's what fans can see, okay? But to beat a dead horse, they're both operating with both hands tied behind their back. They are literally handcuffed. You know, if there's a town, if there's any town in America that knows the impact of bad ownership,
right,
it should be Washington, D.C.
Right.
I know it's a cliche. People, lots of people say, oh, it's blame the owners, you know, they don't spend enough money. But that's reality. That's the reality here. And so, you know, the things that Mike has done bad, the things that Davey has done bad, they can't be disconnected to the lack of ability to do their jobs because of the learners' miserly way of doing business. I mean, it's just, you can't, you know, I keep saying it, but I can't ignore it. I mean, this year they spent $65 million on their active roster. Okay, that's insane. And think about this. Think about, when I talk about being handcuffed by the owners, there's just one example of, I'm sure, many, many more. Okay, in 2019, after the World Series, Ted Lerner signed Steven Strasburg to his seven-year, $245 million contract with Scott Boras.
Right.
He did so behind Mike Rizzo's back. Rizzo was frozen out of the deal.
Why?
Okay. Because Rizzo never would have went for the deal. Mike never would have given Steve Strasburg a seven-year deal, given how fragile he was. Probably less than half that, if anything. So they went behind his back.
Right.
And they made this deal. Now, Steven Strasburg is still getting paid $35 million a year. He's been retired for a couple of years and hasn't pitched in a game of any consequence since the World Series. Okay? That's $35 million a year. That's more than half of the entire active roster payroll the team is spending right now.
Right.
Imagine if they had that, if Mike had that $35 million to add to the $65 million, and then you're looking at $100 million, still paltry, but enough maybe to get a higher level of free agent than Paul DeJong or Jung, Josh Bell, you know, guys like that, you know, Michael Soroka, just to get a little higher level of free agent than that. That's just one example of countless things that the learners have done to basically handcuff their baseball operations people. So when we judge the baseball operations people, I don't think you can fairly judge them without knowing that they've got their hands tied behind their back.
By the way, the Nats' payroll is 27th in the league right now this year. That's where it is among the 30 MLB teams. So,
and it's specific though. I mean, payroll can be interpreted. There's all kinds of different figures.
Right.
Okay. I am going with the active roster payroll.
That's where it is. Active is 27th. Total payroll allocations is 23rd.
Okay. Yeah. That's right. And last year, it was $60 million. And the year before that, it was $60 million.
Yeah. So I had Chelsea Janes from the Washington Post on the show, on the radio show today, and she said something that I thought was interesting. She said that one of the reasons that she was taken aback a little bit about what happened yesterday is that the action was swift and decisive, and that's, you know, out of character for the ownership group, at least, you know, these days. And I'm wondering if, you know, any of that played into your reaction, because many have claimed that they've been disconnected from the reality of the situation and even their part in it. Did you feel that way at all?
Not really. I've come to expect that. They have not been a very active ownership, except with the occasional statement, the occasional mealy-mouthed statement that we get from them. They don't sit down and do interviews. Okay, maybe in spring training, Mark will do an interview with the Post or something like that. No, that didn't surprise me.
Tommy, talk about the ownership, because when Ted Lerner passed away in 2023, you have referred to, you know, there's several people involved. We, as fans, you know Mark Lerner. That's essentially it. He is he's the top dog among the ownership group. But just describe the makeup of the ownership group, because I think that is a mystery to a lot of fans.
Well, I don't know the exact makeup, but the key decision makers here are Mark, his two sisters, and their husbands. Okay.
So Mark, two sisters, and Mark's two brother-in-laws.
Yes.
And they are all involved in the business?
Yes. Well, to some extent.
Okay.
They are all the decision makers. In other words, like, if anything significant has to be done, it should be done with them involved. And the divide, as I understand it, is between the two brother-in-laws and Mark, and Mark's sisters have sided with him.
Mark's sisters have sided with their brother, Mark.
Mark.
And
yes,
the two brother-in-laws want to sell, and the other three don't?
They have been. That has been the position.
Okay.
I have not had much contact this year with them as to whether that's changed, but traditionally that has been the way it's been lined up.
Why do the brother-in-laws have a say in this? Are they equity holders? Do they own?
Yes.
They do.
They're part of the partnership, yeah.
All right, so
and that story I told about Strasburg?
Yeah.
Okay. There are so many more that we don't even know about. And everyone in the league knows this. Okay? They have as bad a reputation as I make them out to have, they have a worse reputation inside the industry of baseball.
Okay.
I'll be real curious how they go about hiring a general manager. Look, we know somebody will come take the job if it's offered. You know, people came to work for Dan Snyder.
Yep.
So there'll always be somebody to take the job, but you're not going to get anybody good. And anybody who takes the job is going to know what Mike knew, that their biggest job every day is to manage upward. That's their biggest job, to manage above them, to manage the family, to manage the ownership.
Mike Rizzo's statement in a text to Barry's Verluga yesterday. The sun will come up tomorrow. That's the job. I had a great run. Navigated that ownership group for almost 20 years.
Yeah.
Have you?
And here's the other thing.
Yeah.
This will be the first time the Learners have hired a general manager.
Right, because he was on Bowden's staff.
Yeah, and it was Stan Kasten.
Right.
Who brought Mike to Washington.
Right.
You know, they inherited Bowden. They didn't fire him until he got caught up in the Smiley Gonzalez scandal.
Right.
And then Stan Kasten hired Rizzo to be the general manager. He had already brought him in as an assistant GM. So they've owned this team for 20 years, and they've never actually had to hire a general manager before.
Do they need to hire a team president who hires a general manager?
That would probably be a good idea.
Okay, you talked about their reputation within baseball. That leads me to this. They're either going to, I mean, it's one of 30 jobs, so somebody's going to take the job just like they did with the football team. We understand that. But are they aware enough of the reputation that they have around the sport? And do you think that they'd be willing to change? Are they capable of changing and then, you know, becoming, you know, an organization that could attract the best of the best in terms of general manager candidates and pay them? And then the same would go for, you know, the open managerial position at the end of this year. I mean, is there any, you know, hope for Nats fans that this reputation is fleeting, and I know it's been around for a while, and that they come to grips with it and change?
I would be shocked if they did anything other than what they've been doing. Look, I mean, having a bad reputation in their industry is not anything new.
No.
For this family.
Right.
Okay.
In their,
it's not,
right.
In their respective businesses.
Right.
That's not, so I don't see them saying, oh my God, you know, we have to change our ways. Not these guys. Not these guys. I mean, the way they've gotten to this point, they're one of the richest owners in Major League Baseball. I don't know how much of a hit they've taken real estate wise, but I'm venturing it's a lot since COVID. But these guys changing, that would be a dramatic turnaround.
I know that we've talked about this in the past, but they did go through a period where they spent money on players.
Yes, they did.
And post-2019 winning the World Series, we had a pandemic. We talked a lot about that, just the worst possible timing for a franchise that really needed the financial boon that comes with winning a World Series, especially when it's the first World Series. I mean, you know, it had been nearly 100 years. And
they were dealt a bad hand.
A really bad hand. Then you, on top of it, the ownership's primary business was commercial real estate, and nobody was going to work. And then, you know, they started to look to sell the team. So we've been in this sort of state of, will they or won't they sell the team? Then Ted Lerner passed away. Like, a lot of things have happened since 2019. What's the most impactful in terms of what's ultimately led to them being super cheap and six hideous losing seasons?
Well, you can't, and I said, you can't deny that when the Nats were drafting in the lower rounds, as opposed to the, you know, top 10 draft picks, when they were winning, their draft picks would be in the lower rounds. And Mike Rizzo's department did not draft well in a lot of those years, and that wound up hurting them. But, you know, this is what happens. If you're not a small market team, you have the ability to overcome your mistakes. That's why I always say, small market teams can't afford to make mistakes. They make a big mistake, and it sets them back for years. But if you're at least a mid-market or mid-to-large market, you have the resources to be able to overcome your mistakes.
Right.
Okay? What happened in a couple of
Did the Nats drafts, have the resources of a big market team at any point?
Not the Red Sox.
I know. But, you know, remember, they had a bad Masson deal, so there was that part, you know, that played into it. But you're suggesting that they were a big enough market that they could have overcome their drafting and developmental, you know, farm system mistakes.
Yes. The Learners claim they've lost $100 million a year. I know for a fact that from 2017 to 2021, they got $300 million in Masson money. Okay. I know that period for a fact, over that five-year period. That's nothing to sneeze at. Last year, or 2023, they got $70 million in Masson money. That's more than what they spent on their entire payroll. So while it wasn't an ideal situation, to use it as a crutch like they did, was disingenuous.
So who are they going to hire? They've got this Mike DiBartolo that's going to take over on an interim basis. Let me just start there. The timing of this, people seem to have a major problem with it. How will it impact both the draft and then, by the way, trade deadline, to which Ken Rosenthal said, if they let DiBartolo be bold, this might be the time to move Mackenzie Gore. He's in the same situation, same year of the Soto deal.
He makes a good point, but that would hurt the Learners. The Learners have gone on record and say that they think they're close to competing. Okay, they think that they're very close to competing, and then to trade your best pitcher when you think you've been telling people you think you're close. No, they won't do that. Remember, another example of what they did to handcuff Rizzo. In the 2018 season, Bryce Harper's last year here as a free agent.
Right.
Rizzo had put together a good deal, with the Houston Astros. For a couple of prospects, a particularly good deal since Harper would only be a rental for the Astros that year. Okay? Rizzo had the deal done. He had his hand on the phone ready to dial. The Learner said, no, don't do it. Don't make the deal. So they wound up getting nothing for Bryce Harper's departure.
Right.
I would think that Gore leaving would be that Bryce Harper fear. They'd be worried about what the signal it sends to their fan base. You know, they've got very peculiar. They care about what the fan base thinks, but only what they want to hear, in very selective hearing.
Yeah, you've said that before. You've said that they do care about what people think about them, but they also kind of lack real reality in terms of how people do think about them. Like, they only want to hear the things that are nice about them, or that's this, all they hear.
This is what we've encountered with so many other people.
Yeah.
In positions of power in sports.
Snyder.
The value of having a voice that will tell you what you need to hear is immeasurable. And few owners in any sports seem to have them.
So what are they going to do now? Mike Rizzo's gone. Dave Martinez is gone. They'll have an interim GM. They already have that. They'll have an interim manager named at some point during today because the Nats are off tonight. They play tomorrow night in St. Louis. As of this recording, they have not named an interim manager. When we get to the end of this season, who are they going to hire? Do you have any names that you're going to write about or that you've thought about? Are they going to be able to attract anybody? What are they going to have to pay? Will they be willing to pay it? They'll get somebody to do the job, but will it be better? Or are we doomed to be kind of what we've been here, which is a big market team, not LA, New York, Boston, Chicago, But certainly a bigger market team that operates as if it's small to mid-market.
I don't know who they're going to hire to manage the team. They're, again, the learners are cheap. They don't spend a lot of money on their managers. Okay, so that's going to come into play. And if they do this right, the general manager, whoever it is, will hire the manager. I mean, that's always the right way to do it.
Right.
So, and I don't know who, you know, there's a couple of candidates that would be out there who would be, and like I said, you know, Dan Snyder got people to come work in Washington. So there's people who would take the general manager's job who are smart people who think, well, I can manage them. You know, I can handle the ownership. So, but as far as candidates, I don't have much to offer you.
I mean, this is a future of watching James Wood turn into a superstar and then end up in New York or LA,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Scott Boras candidate.
Speaking of James Wood, named to the All-Star team along with Mackenzie Gore.
Yeah. Yes, that was good. When you're operating on such a thin dime, like Mike Rizzo has done putting together the team, particularly this year. You know, you have to have some guys who have career years that you pick up, or at least good years, you know, like a Josh Bell or some of the other free agents. Like Michael Soroka was basically the only starting pitcher. The Nats wanted to add a veteran starter. They could only afford Soroka, who got $8 million for a one-year deal. And they only got him because he wanted to be a starter. He's coming off a series of injuries, had been a reliever for a while in Atlanta, wanted to go back to being a starter, and nobody would offer him a starting job. The Nationals were the only team to guarantee him he would have a chance to start. So for three innings, and when he starts, he looks good, and then he falls apart.
Tommy, how did they manage with the learners as owners to have an 8-year run from 2012 through 2019 where they were in the postseason 5 times? They won more games than anybody in Major League Baseball with the exception of the Dodgers, and they won a World Series. With ownership like the learners, how did they have a run like that?
Well, they did have, look, Scott Boras was their adopted son. Okay, they developed a close relationship with Boras, and Boras saw a place where his number one draft pick, Strasburg 1 year, Bryce Harper the next, would have a place to basically, you know, become stars. Okay, and Jason Worth, one of his clients as well, could have a chance to have a big payday and help change the franchise. So Boras and the learners became very tight in the early days of the learners' ownership. And he convinced them to spend money on his clients, I might point out. You know, I'll give you an example of another thing that the learners did. I forget what year it was. Might have been 2013 or something like that. But it was... I'm looking it up right now as we speak.
Okay.
But in 2013, what's his name? Who was the closer before Drew something?
Oh yeah, the one that melted down in Game 5 against the one from Stanford.
Right, but he was their closer going into 2013.
Right.
Okay. But he had a good year.
Drew Storen.
Melted down. But did not play well in the postseason.
Right.
Okay. Ted Lerner called Mike Rizzo one day in the winter and said, I got your closer. Okay. Rafael Soriano.
Yeah.
A Boras client. Made the deal, didn't tell Rizzo. Their closer, the general manager, had no input whatsoever.
Yeah, that's not good.
No.
Not good at all. They had something going right there for a while. Rizzo was doing something right. I remember, you know, this was thought to be a pretty good organization with a good farm system, you know, the likes of Jordan Zimmerman and Anthony Rendon and others. And you don't end up with the second best record over an 8-year period without doing something right there for a while. So it hasn't always been what it's been here in the last few years.
You're right. I mean, like, they had a lot of things. Like I said, a lot of things have to go right when you're playing close to the vest. Okay, they got Mike Morse for nothing from Seattle. He turned into a big home run hitter.
Yeah.
Okay, 30-plus home runs for them. Okay, they got Tanner Roark for nothing in the trade for Christian Guzman. He became a 15-game winner. So they had a couple. The Gio Gonzalez deal, he gave away a bunch of prospects, none of them turned out to be anything, and Gonzalez wound up being a 20-game winner.
Yeah,
so
right.
A lot of things went right.
From the A's,
just
right.
Like they do for any front office. You know? But they're playing so close to the vest now that everything has to be right. There is no room for mistakes. And every team makes mistakes. But some teams say, okay, we made a mistake, let's fix it.
Yeah, we went from understanding what the pandemic meant to the 2020 and 2021 season to then, you know, that horrible season where they, you know, won 55 games, but then the Soto trade, which everybody, you know, congratulates Mike Rizzo on, you know, the players that he was able to bring back from that trade, James Wood, the two All-Stars for starters, Mackenzie Gore and James Wood. And it just seemed like starting in 2023, I remember, you know, Rizzo being, you know, on a show somewhere saying, we're 2 years, we're 2 years away from contending for a wild card spot in the National League playoffs. And he thought that first year would be 24 and then maybe, you know, this year, and certainly wasn't this year.
They won 71 games last year. That's more than what people thought they would win.
Yep, it was, I think the last 2 years were over the total, yeah.
If he had been given the payroll to add a higher level of free agents around those young players, they might have won 80 games last year. Okay, now, but with all that said, this year's roster, you know, the expectations among baseball experts, the Nats were a 68-win team.
Yeah.
At the most.
Yep.
So, you know, despite the excitement out there, the experts did not see that based on the roster they put together. The news is broken that the Nationals have hired Miguel Cairo as the club's interim manager.
Yeah, seeing that.
He
right
has
now.
Been the team's bench coach since 2024.
Okay. What do you know about Miguel Cairo?
Not much. Not much. I mean, he's a friend of Davies.
Yeah.
You know, he was a bench coach for the White Sox. I mean, I don't know much about him.
Will Rizzo get hired by somebody?
Well, it's interesting. I talked to Mike briefly just to see how he's doing. He didn't really offer anything in terms of what his future might be. Yeah, I think he could get hired to a number of GM jobs that if they became vacant. I also think if he wanted to, he could do well in the media because I think he's pretty good with the media. I wouldn't be surprised to see Mike show up on television in postseason baseball.
Yeah, I think he'd be good at that. I agree with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, he'd be good at that.
Yeah.
All right, what else on all of this?
Well, I don't know much about Mike DiBartolo either. That's not a front office guy, the new interim GM. One of Rizzo's guys, not familiar with him much at all.
Well, I'm going to summarize kind of my thoughts here to finish up this opening segment. I wanted to hear, you know, all of what you thought beforehand, because this is an area that you are so much more familiar with in terms of the people and what's been happening over the last many years. But, you know, netting it out, not that I needed yesterday to kind of come to the realization that this is true, but the arrow is not pointing up for this franchise, despite some decent things that are happening. James Wood, Mackenzie Gore, some decent prospects in the pipeline. But as long as the current ownership group is in place, and I don't want to sound like we all sounded for many, many years with Dan Snyder, that as long as Snyder owned the team, they were never going to win. It's not the same thing. I mean, first of all, different people, detestable people in the form of Dan first owned the football team for a long period of time and never had the success that the Lerners had for 8 years as the owners of this franchise. But I think, you know people that have done business with them. I know people in town that have done business with them. And it's always been about business. It's always been about the bottom line. This isn't always about winning. It is the way that they've run their own businesses. They have counted every single dollar, and they are very, very disciplined when it comes to the cost side and running the business and making sure that at the end of, a given business calendar, they made money or they stuck to the way in which they thought they could make money. And I think as long as that's the case, you're going to need that inside straight season. You're going to need, everything to kind of come together for them to, snag a wild card berth, in a given year. I mean, think about the competition. They are running a business. They are more mid to small market minded, and they're competing with the Mets and the Phillies and the Braves in their own division, let alone the Dodgers and the Cubs and other big spending National League franchises. So, absent that, season in which everything comes together they get, they're healthy and they have a couple of outlier years from two or three players and two or three pitchers, and they win 86 games and they snag a wild card berth. Yeah, overall the arrow just seems to be right now, as long as current ownership exists, not pointing up.
That speaks to the idea when you're a small market team, you can't afford to make a mistake that'll set you back. Okay, guys, teams like the Royals of Tampa Bay do a great job. You can't afford to make mistakes. You don't have that luxury. The Nationals aren't the Yankees, but they still should have been in a position to say, okay, we're not getting our players from our farm system. Let's go out and spend a little bit more money. Okay, I'm not talking about, Jason Worth kind of money, Bryce Harper kind of money. I'm talking about mid-level free agents. Okay, not Josh Bell for 1 year, $5 million.
Right.
Okay, and they were certainly capable of doing that.
Mike wasn't surprised, right?
I didn't get this from Mike. And I know he really likes living in Washington.
Right.
He loves the area.
Yeah.
He's established some deep roots here in D.C. But on the other hand, there has to be a sense of relief for him. I don't know about Davey so much, but I always thought that there was a sense of fatigue that had set in. Like they were just fighting against their own team instead of fighting other teams. They had to wake up every day to fight against their own team. And I think that took its toll on both of them.
Right.
Because Davey never gave a hint that he was unhappy with the owners. Once in a while, he would use the word, and this was the key word. They both used it. Hopefully.
Right.
They would, once in a while, they would occasionally say, hopefully we'll be able to spend money. Hopefully this. Hopefully that, when it was totally in their control. There was nothing to hope for except that their owners would do what they're asking.
All right, that was from the podcast yesterday. The news about the interim manager broke, obviously, during that. When we come back, Grant Paulson will be our guest. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980.
All right, some updates from Wimbledon as Taylor Fritz has defeated Karen Khachanov in a tiebreak to advance to the semifinal. He will face the winner of Cam Nori and Carlos Alcaraz, which gets underway shortly. And Arnia Sabalenka is currently tied with Laura Sigmund at one set apiece. And American Amanda Anisimova takes on Anastasia Pavlyuchenkova at 10:00 after this game. And the NBA, Devin Booker signed a 2-year, $150 million extension to stay in Phoenix. Paolo Banchero signed a 5-year rookie max extension with Orlando worth up to $287 million. And the Pacers confirmed that Tyrese Halliburton will miss all of next season with a ruptured Achilles tendon. The Nats. New era begins tonight in St. Louis. Former Nats bench coach Miguel Cairo will make his managerial debut with the team today. 7:45 is first pitch, and Nats on deck with Charlie and Dave at 7:15. This update is sponsored by the Team 980 YouTube page. Just open the app, type in the Team 980, hit subscribe. Kevin Sheehan is live from 10 to 1 and Craig Hoffman from 4 to 7. Don't forget to like the stream and turn on notifications to stay up to date on all things DC sports. And that is what's trending.
All right, I've got some good news and I've got some great news. The good news is that Amazon Prime Day is here. The great news, this year you'll have 4 days to find deals on all your favorite things. Shop Prime Day now through July 11th at Amazon.com.